Well, let's start out here with the familiar hypocephalus. We're going to start out with the picture right now. Brother? Here is the Henry Muir. He has we had the bad machine up there before. Oh, this is a good one now. This is the Henry Muir. Now you notice the obvious here is that yes, there's a little arrow there, you see. That the upper, what you might call the solar portion of the standard hypocephalus, and this is a good standard one, is divided not only up and down, you see, but also right and left by, the batteries are pretty weak here. See a line right down the middle. They face equally in either directions. The line down the middle, so it's quadrate here, you see. In four directions, it's quadrata. And, of course, that's universal pattern of the cosmos. But figure one has four faces. The one in the center, as you see, has four faces. Should be facing in all directions, as you know. Two pointing in either direction here. And he's seated on the ground. On all of them, he's never seated on a throne, as you expect him. He's seated on the ground with knees facing one direction here. He's just one direction. But if we look at the mate to this one, the Leiden Fasciri, he's double, as in the Joseph Smith. He has two sets of knees, and he's two people here. Well, that's the same. That's just a way of showing you that this person is the one and the same person. This person is going in both directions, but make sure it's one and the same. See, on the other one, they just drew him once. On the other one, they just had him sitting once. But they made it here. They want to emphasize the fact that he's one and the same person, but dual, facing in all directions. I had a remark here. Let me see if I can find it. Yes, here. How can two different entities, I'm just slipping this in here, how can two different entities be the same? Well, Heisenberg says, the concept of complementarity is meant to describe a situation in which we can look one and the same event through two different frames of reference. Same person. Which way he's facing makes a different person if he's facing the other direction, yet he's the same person. These two frames mutually exclude each other, but they also complement each other, and only the juxtaposition of the two contrary frames provides a real exhaustive view of the situation, and that's what we have here, you see. They're complementary and they go together. The well-known coincidentia positorum. In the upper figure is very much on the go, as you can see. He is striding forth with the Wepwawet staff. And this is a very interesting thing here on this one. Here they play around with these somewhat. This is the Yu'enech Netzru Nebu. All the gods belong to thee, it says here on his right. We're talking about the above one. This isn't working at all now. Oh, there it is. Yes, there it is. All gods belong to him. But here it says, he knoweth. Because this is going to he knows. He knows what's going on. Notice it's right above Wepwawet, the dog. This is the Pershgang, as the Germans call it. This is the hound that runs ahead, and he's to explore the new lands, whether it's the underworld or other worlds. And this says he knows where he's going. Probably it means that. There are a couple of others in which like inscriptions are found, but this I think is unique here, where it says he knows, Yurech, he is one who knows. That's an active participle. He is a knower and he's leading the way, and I think it's very significant that it's on this side with over the dog and not on the other side. Well, so he runs ahead of his master leading the way into unknown territory, so he's the one who should know the way. He's at the top of the world. Almost all hypocephalus, his tall ammon feathers, see here, on almost all of them, that's hard, these feathers on top, they could be accommodated to the rim, but they almost never are. On almost all of them, let's look back at the other one now, and see how it is. See, it touches the top, but the Joseph Smith one that goes through, 90% of them, the two ammon feathers go above the rim, and they're supposed to go above the rim. He goes out of bounds. He's They mark the point at which the circular discourse on the rim begins and ends. You notice the one where it talks about the Ancient of Days, the great old man, the prince. It begins with him, and it ends with him. And the Joseph Smith begins and ends with him. This is where you start, you go around, you come back home where you started. Then, the great old man of Heliopolis. That's where this all takes place. He can hardly be anything but the sun at his zenith, the point at which going literally both ways at once, see, at the zenith, the moment at which the sun, having come as high as it will, either in the day or in the year, then at that moment it starts to go down. So it's both going up and down at the same time, like a wheel on the ground, you see. A wheel on the ground going 100 miles an hour, the point in contact with the ground is dead still. Otherwise, the wheel is skidding. As it is, you see, this mysterious moment, this primordial in which everything stops, he's not going up anymore, now he's going down, and that's why he has to have two faces. He's going in both directions at once. And then, at the sun of his zenith, and that's whether it's in the day, at noon, or whether it's in the year, the summer solstice, then it starts going down, the shadows start getting longer, and so forth. And then, losing our place all the way here, the inscriptions accompanying the god confirm the idea. He is all motions. We just say where it said, I know, but on some others, well, I think we get another one here. It will show us that. Now, here's a good one, you see. This has an inscription here. And it says here, Eurechi, I've known, I shall know, I shall know, and I have known. Eurechui, they're both active verbs. They're not passives, not I am known, but they're actives. And according to Gardner, this would mean, I am one who has known, I am one who knows, and I am one who has known. See, he knows the past, and he shall know the future. Working in both directions. They use the know in another context on the other one. But Eurechi, active participle, you see, third person singular, Rechi, and this is the all perfective, I am one who is in the condition of having known, or has known. Of course, this is complicated by the fact that verbs of the heart in Semitic languages lean to the perfective. Almost, you know, we say in Greek, gignosko. You don't say I know, you don't say gnoso. You say gignosko, I have known. So in the same way in Arabic, I have known, I have understood, and so forth. You always put it in the past. If you know, that means you have known. You don't know all of a sudden right now. Well, let's not argue about that. I have to get on here because inscriptions accompanying the god confirm the idea. As I say, he's all motion. The central figure, on the other hand, is sublimely stable, as you can see. And he's always sitting on the ground. I say he's not sitting anywhere else. And if he's not on a throne from which he might arise, but is in this direct contact with the ground, and he commands all things from where he sits with a face to supervise each of the cardinal regions, the universal. Here we pause to pay respects to Antaeus. Remember, Antaeus was the king of Libya, and all his strength came from his contact with the ground, and he wrestled Hercules when Hercules came there. He wrestled all his guests and put them to death, but Hercules beat him and destroyed him by holding up in the air so he couldn't get his strength from Mother Earth. So he had to be in contact with the ground, and when Hercules held him up, Antaeus lost his strength. Well, then Hercules went right next door to Egypt, to the Delta, where his brother Busiris, the cruel Busiris, he was Pharaoh. And Pharaoh wanted to do the very same thing to Hercules. He wanted to sacrifice him on an altar. And he was about to sacrifice him on the altar. Hercules prayed and was given more super strength than he already had. He was able to, the altar was overthrown. He was able to slay the priest and two famous jugs, the most famous of the early jugs, called the Busiris vases, a number of them in the Athens Museum, show the picture of Pharaoh pleading on his knees for Heracles to spell it, to save his life, and the priest running away, and Heracles is holding the high priest by the throat, and the altar is there, and so forth. Well, immediately, of course, we think of the Abraham sequence. Abraham is a stranger. Pharaoh tried to sacrifice him on an altar. Same thing, we go through this routine again. But this Antaeus story, is this why he's sitting on the ground, in other words? It's an Egyptian tradition, as far as that goes, to rush on here. Otherwise, we'll never get anywhere. It's not surprising that the first scholars to study hypocephali, trained as they were in the classics, were quick to point out the significant resemblance between the two and four-headed figures in the disc and the god Janus, the oldest, most venerable, and most mysterious of all Roman gods. This was Knum, the four-headed one. I'm going to read you something. This is the wrong one. This is from the wrong wall of the Esna temple. I thought it was the inscription from the other wall, but I have the inscription from the other wall, and with your kind permission, I'll read this one. This was it's partly cryptogram, but Darcy has given us a rendition of it and discussed various things and so forth. And this is what it says about Knum, who is good old Neat, who is good old Asinus, who is good old Asina, and so forth. And it says, boy, that's fine print, isn't it? It says here, thank you. He created all mankind as a bee makes honey. Right out there, they're the bee goddesses. Remember, Neith is the bee goddess, Asinus is the bee goddess, and Deseret, of course, is the king, and he created all men as the bee makes honey. And remember, Knum is identical with Neith. We talked about that series the last time. And it says, it goes on here, he lives for eternity, he calls to exist all that exists. His aspect is that of a living ram, always. The most powerful, the rampant ram, the prince of universe of the four gods, who were united in his one person, the god with the four heads on one neck, which is what we have in the center, you see, as you know, a very hypocephalus. Lord of Elephantine, he is the ram of Re, he is the ram Shu, as the lord of Letopolis. He is the ram of Osiris, as the lord of Hypsilus. He is Geb, the earth god, as the ram, and unites himself with another excellent, well, the word is Shepsis, means noble, august, and so forth, ram, the prince, the august prince, who is in Hierapolis. And he is the male, the ram of Tuimus, and he is the begetter who is in Mendes. Of course, the ram of Mendes is the reproductive one. And he, above all, it says, is Knum, who begot all the gods and all the men. So we're coming back. So who is the central figure, you see, on our facsimile? It would be Knum. But Knum is also, he says, is also Ammon. So does that bother you? Well, just as we saw before, say that passage from Heisenberg, it depends on the point of view on how you want to treat it now. This stuff is just as abstract, see, as some of the symbols used in science today. And the Egyptians understood it as such. So, we rush on. So this is Saturn. Well, let's see. Now, there's a classic picture of Saturn, of Janus, rather. They recognize Janus. Remember, he's the two-headed god, facing in either direction. Here they have the moon on top of him. And because this principle is in all your hypocephali, I see. He is the most venerable, the most mysterious of all Roman gods. Having observed the striking parallels, the doctors let it go at that. No serious effort was ever made to follow up this strange phenomenon. The venerable Thomas Bulfinch is good for a quick rundown on Janus. We'll just read what this character is, and immediately we'll recognize he should have the two heads and so forth. Janus, but remember, Janus had two heads or four. He was Janus quadrifrons or Janus bifrons. We'll see presently either one. He has to be both. Janus was a deity unknown to the Greeks, but from the earliest times held in high estimation by the Romans, who placed him on almost equal footing with Jupiter, even giving his name preference in their prayers, invoking the aid of both deities previous to every undertaking. To him they ascribed the origin of all things, the introduction of a system of years, the change of seasons, the ups and downs of fortune, the civilization of the human race by means of agriculture, industry, arts, and religion. There's good old Knum. See, we just read it with Knum, and now it's Janus here. He was represented with two heads, one benign, that of a youth, to indicate beginning, the other an old man, to indicate end, whence he was styled bifrons, or two-headed. In his left hand is a key to show that he opens at the beginning and shuts, remember, a janitor is one who keeps the keys, at the end and shuts at the end. The scepter in his right hand is a sign that he controls the progress of every undertaking. The first day of January, a month named after him, being the first day of the new year, was the occasion of a celebration in his honor. At the beginning of every month, the priests offered sacrifice to him at 12 altars. He was invoked every morning at the beginning of the new day. See, the new anything, whatever it's new, it's Janus. That's, you know, that's the idea when you have it, the doubling. Janus opened and closed all things. He sat not only on the confines of the earth, but also at the gates of heaven. Air, sea, and land are in the hollow of his hand. The world moves on its hinges at his command. The public worship of Janus as a god was introduced into Rome as early as the time of Numa. So the foundation for the establishment was laid as early as the reign of Romulus. When a temple was erected in honor of Janus, the gates of which stood open so long as Rome was at war and were closed with great ceremony and rejoicing only in times of general peace, which was only three times in the 700-year history of Rome. They only had peace that long to close the door of Janus in the course of 700 years. Well, as noted, Janus takes two forms. A two-faced aspect, and of course this is what we have on our hypocephali. You can go back and look at them again. Well, see, there's the two forms, the two heads above and the four heads below. And they have the two titles, bifrons, double brow, double front, bifront, bifrontal, and quadrifrons, or quadrifrontal. The latter was described by Roman poet as a ram in the midst of heaven, medium caelum quasi mundum vertex, holding the scepter of his vasta custodio mundi, sitting in the middle, the highest point of the heaven, the vertex. It's not, you see, the solstice, but it is the... It is directly overhead, you see, on the azimuth. The medium caelum cross as the very vertex of the universe, holding in his scepter the vasta custodia, the custodia of the vast custodianship of the, see, a janitor is a custodian after all, of the universe. Who would fail to recall our figure one on the hypocephaly, with his four rammed heads facing in all directions, course, holding his vast scepter, the symbol of supreme power, as he sits in the center of the heavens? Well, sometimes Janus has two faces, sometimes four. St. Augustine observed he's called double Janus, says Augustine, is yet interpreted as four parts, even though they call him double. They are one and the same. That observation is supported by Macrobius, who says Janus is represented as two-faced as the janitor of the upper and lower regions. He keeps the door where you go in or out, you see. But as four-faced as embracing the four regions, the climata, he says, the four climata of the universe in his majesty. That's a different thing entirely, you see. It's stable, universal, but one is motion. That irresistibly invokes the two and four-faced deities in the hypocephali, of course. All representing the same deity, all crowned with the ram's horns, they must wear them. Both in Rome and Egypt, elsewhere throughout the world, and for obvious reasons, the ram's horn proclaimed the primacy of the wearer in leadership and aggression. In looking up for something for a Book of Mormon class yesterday, I found this statement in the tomb of Petosiris, a priest from the 5th century BC, a very important man. But this shows you how freely they can play around with these things. It's the prophet Petosiris, Re, who established the blessed, the knot of the seven gods. Petosiris is Re. When Petosiris is strong, Re is strong. When Re is strong, Petosiris is strong. The hair of Petosiris is that of Nun. His face is that of Re. His eyes are those of Hathor. His ears are those of Wepwawet. Very sharp, you see. His nose is that of Khentamenti. His lips, those of Anubis. His teeth, those of Serket. His neck, that of Isis. His arms, Osiris, the ram of Mendes, his arms, and his so forth, and his forearm is Neith, and his back is Set, and so forth. Well, this is a good example of how Egyptian symbols, not unlike modern mathematical, chemical, engineering symbols, retain recognizable forms, rather unlike them, of ideograms. You can still recognize them as pictures, you see, that's different. Though they are just as abstract as our own. Aries the ram is the head of the zodiac, the leader of the flock, etc. He always comes first. But January also comes first. He begins the solar year, and the Porta Janalis is the gate of Rome, which was called the gate of Mars. It was the gate of Aries. So they have no objection to doing that. It's just the start of something else. And it was opened in the month of Aries, the month of March, when the army would go forth, you see. There's nothing wrong with having Janus wear the ram's horns to show that he too is number one, the horns meaning beginning, leadership, parentage, and so forth. Those horns tell you just as plain as anything what you're talking about. It's like making an increment sign, you saw in math. That's what it is. And the Roman god is, these things mark the Roman god as Janus Pater, Father Janus. the primal parent and ancestor of all, the great creator and procreator, and also the renewer of life as the sun, affecting the renewal of the universe at the winter solstice. Figure 1 in the hypocephali is the first of these attributes as the paternal, all-powerful one, while figure 2 presents the second, the eternal cycle of the sun, giving light and life to the world. When the sun is in the ram, says Hajinus, omnia nascentia recreantur, all things are born to renewal. His scepter is the virginalis, the staff of Janus, proclaiming his office as king and begetter of the human race, being the staff that opens the womb of earth, bringing forth the springs of life, giving of life-giving water, and all the vegetation that follows. The Egyptian design of our figure as Janus quadriphones is Khnum, as I mentioned before, and this hymn from Khnum shows he's the same universal person. Now, these ideas survive in folklore all over the world, the four-headed god seated in the middle of the cosmic circle, facing all points of the compass, suffusing light in all directions, is this figure of sublime stability, and he's a stock theme, actually, in the mandalas of Baroque churches. The two-headed god, we're not going to get sidetracked on that, the two-headed god, on the other hand, is the quintessence of endless motion, marking Janus as preeminently the god of passage, of gates, of roads, of doors. Janua mean bridges, water gates, and this is, say, janitor. In this capacity, his staff is the key. He's the kleidoukos, the holder of the key. He's the janitor, whose rod opens all roads, exactly like the Egyptian whip-wallet staff, held by the forward, striding, double-faced, horn-crowned, light crown, for that's the symbol of the two tall feathers he's wearing. The man at the very top of the hypocephalus ring, who is called Re in some inscriptions. In the Joseph Smith inscription, which has been damaged, he's called Re there. Here is Janus as the sun at the critical moment of transition from one cycle rage to the next. We mentioned that before. Both the ancient and modern scholars have found two etymologies for the name. The one is Dianus, Janus, meaning the bright light of the sky, Dianus, and the other Ianus, the one who goes in the circle, Anus annular, see, annual year and so forth is a circle. Annular eclipses, around eclipse and so forth. The one who is on the go, our word year is related. Specifically moving, quote, in a circle which constitutes the two polar halves of time and space. Janus being the sun at the solstice. That's a quotation from August Hoot on a book on Janus, which we don't have in our library. Two faces sometimes shown as those of youth and age represent the past and future, winter of summer, war and peace. The Porta Janalis was open for war and shut for peace, light and darkness. They're always inseparable, for at the same instance in which he passes from one to the other, well, we mentioned that all. So Altheim says he is the most compelling, primordial, compelling image of eternal becoming and passing away, of life and death, in short, of the elementary polarity and duality of life. This is what Arthur Koestler has called the Janus principle. That versatile scientist has written a book summing up the philosophy of his researches, and the title of the book is simply Janus, A Summing Up. It calls it the Janus principle. It's nowhere more perfectly embodied than in the hypocephalus, as explained by Joseph Smith. We'll get to that later if you ever had time. To begin with, Koestler expounds, parts and whole, in an absolute sense, do not exist anywhere, either in the domain of living organisms, or in social organizations, or in the universe at large, unquote. Everything belongs to something larger, and itself integrates something smaller than itself. All the parts of a system, quoting him again, are subordinate as parts to a higher center in the hierarchy, but at the same time function as quasi-autonomous wholes. They are Janus-faced, he says, we're still quoting him. The face turned upward toward higher levels is that of a dependent part. Remember, because Joseph Smith is so interested in relationships and hierarchy here, and he says Janus, and the Janus principle says hierarchy is everything, is what Koestler says here, is that of the whole remarkable, toward its constituents, is that of a whole of remarkable self-sufficiency. Each member of a hierarchy, on whatever level, is a sub-hole or a holon. He invents this word. Doesn't really invent it, because what we have here, of course, is a hologram. A holon, that's the Greek word holon, not our word whole, but of course, cognate, same one. He calls it a holon. That is to say, a sub-hole or holon in its own right, a stable, integrated structure equipped with self-regulatory devices, enjoying separate little universes, you know, enjoying a considerable degree of autonomy or self-government. biological holons, or organisms, down to organelles, those smaller than cells, are self-regulating entities which manifest both independent properties of the whole and the dependent properties of the parts. We may call it the Janus principle. So Kessler invents this Janus principle to explain that, which is usefully explained in 93rd section of Doctrine, Covenants, and so forth, but here especially it's represented, because all these opposites and things, and yet the one dependent on the other, and then the higher and the lower, you go down. Where history, especially chronology, so I'm going to skip this. It's a very good part, but I'm going to skip it anyway, because let's see what you said here. The part must be, well, it's a good quotation. The part must be independent entity that has something to contribute, even when set apart by itself. But as part, it also belongs to the larger whole. The larger whole, in turn, itself is part of a still larger. The organism is to be regarded as, we're quoting here from Professor, is to be regarded as a multi-leveled hierarchy of semi-autonomous sub-wholes branching into sub-wholes of a low order, and so on. Parts and wholes, in an absolute sense, do not exist in the dominion of life. But the point is that they go on forever in both directions. And again, the Pythagoras, Diogenes Laertes tells us in the 19th book that Pythagoras taught that very same thing, and what he gives us here as his doctrine might be a description of a hypocephalus. And Aristotle tells us in the Metaphysics, Pythagoras teaches that tenantia archai ton onton, that opposites are the beginnings of all things. It begins in opposites, of course, that's Hegel and all that sort of thing. The Janus principle of opposites. But with the opposites, you get an endless hierarchy. And so he says here, and arithmon ene, and number is the very nature of everything. And then he says, Aristotle says, Pythagoras first taught that the universe is eternal and without beginning. So these things all go together in the same, and it takes us into Joseph Smith's cosmology, doesn't it? Very much with our Book of Abraham. But you have both in the text and in this one. Well, here. In this coincidence of opposites, the generative meaning of male and female is inescapable. We notice this is the female down below, everybody's female down there, and up above it's the male, the solar and the phonion. And his mate was his part, and it was him. He was identified, they fused together, Janus and the Lady Karna. The Lady Karna is a sort of counterpart to Janus. As Janus Caris, he's called, remember Ceres is the mother of Earth, where the Romans, we're talking about Romans, not Greeks now, you see. As Janus Caris, he himself is the counterpart of Ceres, as neat is of Cnum. Operating with her, he opens the womb of waters under the earth to bring forth life at the new year. In his endless circuit through the cosmos, he must, like the Egyptian ray, pass through the darkness of the underworld, of course. He operates on a grand scale. The diurnal cycle is less to him than the grand cycles of creation. Dispensations. On the dark side, he's Consus. And this is very interesting because we talked about Khonsu, the moon god, Khonsus. Oops, we got the Egyptian first in here, didn't we? I wonder if they're related. Khonsus was from Khondra, meaning to hide, to conceal, and so forth. And the Egyptian is Khonsus. That means to stride across the heavens. Khonsus to, that's the motion of the moon across the sky, Khonsus, and Khonsu is the moon in his motion. But Khonsus, the moon is against the sun. And so here we have, he is Khonsus, whose name means concealment, Khondra, darkness. In total contrast to the shining Janus, ever striding forward with his way-opening staff, Khonsus is the end of the road. Everything comes to a dead stop there. And the bottom, the two bottom lines of the Joseph Smith hypocephalus are very eloquent on that subject, if you ever get around to it. Khonsus is the end of the road. The final wind-up, says this, the final wind-up and coalition of the old seculum, or the life cycle. It's the Egyptian noon, and he says, das Bergen und Abschluss des Alten Bergen, the putting away and burying, putting aside and closing the book on the old year. It brings everything to a halt, actually, and of course in Rome they put the seed in the bin of Ceres in the capital of Ceres, the lady, you see, and it was to remain in the seed. January went now. So, the buried seed, you see. You don't hear much about Khonsus, who holds the buried seed in the dark depths of the earth awaiting the new year. He waits the spring, because, which is the, not January, see, but March here, because he's too negative. Cheerful Janus is preferred. Janus gives us the life-saving advantage of a broken symmetry, for he opens more than he closes. Now, Sater has written on that very interestingly. January is the beginning. They emphasize the beginning rather than the ending of the year, yet he's neither the one person nor the other, but both. The abstract idea of passage, he says here. His doubled gate at the forum led both in and out. He sat not on either side of the cosmic stream, but directly in the middle of the bridge that crossed it, and he controlled the bridge. We're reminded of the double-headed lion, Ruti, or Acher, with faces in opposite directions here. Along. Yes, here's Ruti. We've seen him before. You see, this is, notice these double lions here, and we have a beautiful example here of the of Acher. We'll come to the one from the papyrus of Ani, which is very eloquent here. With faces in opposite directions, the one labeled yesterday and the other tomorrow, and that's what we have next. Yes, here, this is from the papyrus of Ani. Notice the lions there. Everything is at peace here. The people are in a in an interstate. They're playing games and resting in the booth while they're spirits. You see, they are spirits. Notice these are the same people all along here while they're both spirits, but they're in a pleasant place. And here the lion, this denotes the passing of time, as you can see by the sun on the horizon. But also this one is labeled, this is Dua, is labeled tomorrow, and this one is labeled yesterday on the other hand. Notice they wear these jaunted little caps to show they're at peace, they're tamed lions. But notice their labels. This is important. This is labeled tomorrow, and this is labeled yesterday. So they're facing in either direction, looking forward from the time when the body shall rise. And there's the Bennu, there's the phoenix that is to bring the spirit again and all the rest of the things. But we remind the double-headed lion, here he is again, day and tomorrow. His staff opens both the way. Oh, wait, there's something very important in here I must show you. This is too good to lose. I just noticed it when I was setting it up for the here it is. Notice it explains when it comes to this, what does this mean? This asks, notice, whenever you see the red ink, it says, what does this mean? What's the explanation? This is a lesson here. And it says, what is this? Parity ref, what is this then? And then he says, as to, oh, this thing isn't working at all. As to, do I have a pointer? I'm pointing right at the thing. Damn. Feed a darn batteries out now. As to yesterday, it is Osiris. As to tomorrow, it is Re. See, Re is the sun coming up for tomorrow, and yesterday is Osiris, who's been buried. But then it goes on and explains here, Pal, in the day when they destroyed the enemies, his enemies, and he says, of the Lord of Neberger, of the Most High God, with the great battle in heaven. On the day when the great time of decision, when the plan was decided on, when they destroyed the enemies of the Most High God, the Neberger here, UF, he is along with his son on the throne here. And then it says, as for that day we're talking about, this is the day we celebrate here. He says, it's the day we celebrate when, and this is Dehentep, when Osiris, when Ra comes down and lays himself upon the body of Osiris, the two join together, and the erection, that's your Demi, we mentioned that before, Jemma Demji. We talked a lot about Jemma Demji, and that's what he's talking about here. See, there he is here, the Dehen lays upon the Keras, upon the body, Pel, that body which is Pel, of Osiris by his father, Ray, and it calls Ray his father here, and Yitof F. Ray. So here we got the Deva Jemdi. That comes into our surprise. But see what's happening here. All these things center around the same themes, and it's a very consistent story here. And then his staff opens both the ways of heaven and earth. His key makes him Janus Patokius, the opener, and Janus Clusius, the closer. The same word we use, see. Long ago, J.P. Renouf compared these Latin epithets with the Egyptian ones applied to the sun god in the Book of the Dead, chapter 17. This is from chapter 17, that very important document. I am he who closes and he who opens, and I am but one. Who closes is Tem, which means to close. He who opens is Wenen, which means to open the gates. As the god who closes and opens is the same, I am but one. It's the ultimate mystery of the Jemma Demji, you see, in which the beginning with which we began here. Renouf later pointed out that the speaker as Osiris is identical with Janus, and also with the four-headed god of many names lighting up the heavens and earth with his rays, whom Renouf identifies with the central figure. Long ago, Renouf identified that figure, that Janus figure, with the center of the Walter Nash Papyrus. Hypocephalus was already spotted there, that this is what it was, and then he forgot all about it. There is yet more. In the Hypocephali from Abydos, the two-faced god at the top is flanked on one side by a solar bark, and the inscription declaring, well, if we just go back, all we have to do is find a... we'll go back some more. Come on. Keep going. And we just... Oh, come on. All I have to do is find... There's one, you see. You see the ships on one side. This one on the right, you see, with the bird with outspread wings. That's Sokar. He's rising from mummy bandages. That's very old, probably the oldest thing on it. And the other one on the side is a lunar bark with the Khepru. That's another story. But we can't analyze the figures yet. I doubt if we even get around to that. And these ships now, these ships praising the ship of the god, this is important. We were talking about Khonsu, weren't we? And his ship. Well, Khonsu's in the ship. This is the ship of Khonsu over here. That's right. And yet it's the ship of Sokar. It's called the Sokar ship of Khonsu. The sun ship, as it reaches the darkest recesses of the underworld and nearly comes to a halt. The original name of Janus, the bright one, and the dark one were respectively Janus and Khonsus. Janus, Khonsus, the dark one, you see. And resembling each other no more closely than do the nature and functions of the two gods. Both represent darkness, hiding, concealment. Janus is the moment of annual transition to the sun, so Khonsus represents the transitions of the sun, and especially the moon. And of course, Khonsu is the moon. Khonsu is the passage of the moon across the sky. Khonsu, like Janus, is a double-faced, being both sun and moon, and his name signifies that he's always on the go. Khenis, that's what it means, I say. Khenis in the heavens. A perfect match for the striding Janus figure. And speaking of barks in these ships, the indispensable accompaniment and trademark of Janus, he has just one symbol, and that's the Janus ship. Janus ship, the prating of the ship of the god with great splendor at the new year, of course, because it's January. Ah, there it is. This is, notice that's that same figure, which was figure 4 on our Hypocephalus. That's that boat with a bird emerging, you see, emerging with outspread wings. And that's a very archaic, Duchesne wrote a whole monograph about this type of boat. But you see, it has handles for carrying it around. It's to be carried in procession. It's on a sled for when it's in the temple, then when it's picked up, it's carried around by priests once a year in a grand procession. Well, they did the very same thing with the ship of Janus in Rome. That's where you get our word carnival, the naval car. With a ship mounted on it. It doesn't have to do with carnival, farewell to meet at all. The parading of the ship with the god with great splendor at the new year was much the custom in early Rome as it was in Egypt and Mesopotamia, for that matter. It's from that we get the word carnival, and the parading of the Sokar bark was to celebrate its passing through the depths of the underworld. We see the Sokar figure in his ship emerging from his mummy wrappings. As early as the First Dynasty, we find the famous ivory comb of King Jer in the First Dynasty, the hawk above the ship with outspread wings, the sign of the resurrection and the sign of the expanse of the heavens, as Joseph Smith says it is. The celestial ships are highly visible on the Hypocephali, and so it's not surprising that one symbol alone is Janus's seal and signature, so to speak. It's the Janus ship, signifying, like the ship of Khonsu, Sokar, the passage of all things from one face to another. Virtually the only memorials we have of Janus are the so-called the Janus ass. The ass, that's the old Roman word for bronze or copper. It's the ass. The Janus ass was a big bronze circle, a big bronze ring, a disc, with the ship of Janus on one side and the face of Janus on the other, and that's all it was. And, of course, that's what we have here. It was a heavy bronze or copper disc, like a medallion, on the side, one side of which was the double face of Janus, on the other, always and only a picture of a Janus ship. These talismans were exchanged as good luck gifts by the Romans, along with birthday wishes. Everybody considered the new year his own birthday in Rome. That was the rule. Round cakes with lighted candles, the zodiac, were also exchanged, along with little Janus lamps, everything to suggest the sun's beginning of a new and auspicious year. Again, we are met by the strangeness of the thing. This is like no other Roman god. Janus has no statue. That's not an ancient statue. He has no image. He has no cult, no proper ceremony, no temple, no myths, no legends. He seems to be, as Alzheimer says, a pure abstraction, a nomen actionis signifying the act of going, perpetual motion. As consul, he's just as abstract, nothing but hiding, concealing, and passage in the dark. Janus' cult was also unique. It was unknown to the Greeks, though Lydus reports that both the Egyptians and Babylonians had their own archaic Janiform god. Classical scholars insist, and I quote here, Janus is not found either in Greek or Oriental or in any other religion of antiquity. Like everything else we found out about this, it's always unique, it comes out. At least, we would add, not by that name. Though his tokens like Christmas and Easter and symbol were in a modern department store were always popular with the masses, they knew nothing about his real cult at all. It was a complete mystery, and it was shared by a very select group, a small aristocratic priestly circle of initiates, and their whole study was astronomy. That was what they were devoted to, not philosophy or even religion as far as that goes. So here we're back to our cosmology again. Since Janus was not a perishable mortal, what about our Janus story, the descent to, ascent to heaven and so forth? The Janus drama with the hero in extremis. But such puts in a stellar appearance if we take one step back to the more primitive aspects of the cult. For students of comparative religion, mostly classical scholars easily found enlightening parallels to that bizarre character in the antiquity of their own northern homelands. Where Janus is concerned, writes Otto Hut, it was become apparent that the Romans stood in a position of closest relationship with the Germans and Celts. His symbol of the polarized circle was the year rune, the circle divided in half, that appears in prehistoric Scandinavian glyphs along with the well-known solar funeral ships. And the Virga Genalis in the north is the white thorn staff, which, like the mistletoe, opens all locks, doors, springs, and ways to the underworld. His horns have the significance of the Germanic Luren, and the celebration of his seculum was marked in Rome as at the new year and in the north by the solemn ceremonial driving of a nail to hold everything fast, the great year nail of the temple. The symbol of Janus, the time rune, is also that of Mother Earth. Janus coins are found among the Celts with double faces on one side. Instead of the ship, we see the continental horse and sun wheel that he's pulling, like the Trundholm wagon, signifying the same passage of the year. King Lear's underwater burial, which A.B. Cook considered to be the oldest in Europe, was in the shrine of Janus. Since Kessler is at pains to point out the Janus principle applies to all things, there should be nothing particularly remarkable about its occurrence in Hypocephalus, with figures 1 and 2 split neatly down the middle, noon and midnight, summer and winter, past and present, or the disk itself being divided into opposing worlds. After all, everybody knows, Egypt itself was divided into equally red and white thrones, which belong to the rival claims of Horus and Seth. They neglected the two Horuses. We should mention the two Horuses because they're very interesting. They look exactly alike, and they're called Khonsu, and we see them united in a perfect wedge-out eye here. This is an interesting one. This is the Vienna, incidentally. This is the Vienna one, the closest one to the Joseph Smith. Notice up at the top, you reckon, he says, he knows. It also is written under the staff. It says, the dog knows the way. You see, he knows. And so we have, there's Joseph Smith again. And here it is, you see, these are the two Horuses. But notice he's called Khonsu here. They're called the two Horuses, and facing in either direction, and with the Nahas sign of authority and so forth. But here it is again, but here he is called Reharachti, he's called Harachti here, but you notice he has two heads facing in the two directions, and they're united in the Wedjat eye, the perfect restoration of all things. The Wedjat is the completion, perfection, restoration of all things, and they're united in that, you see, and it says, Reharachti speaks, the great God, who is that? The one of the two faces. See, there is two faces. Heriab, who is the holder of the two faces, and who has many forms, great forms, and who is mighty of strength, in this form of the, and then it says of the Jerti, Jeri in this case means a kite, a bird called a kite, of the two kites is in his mighty form. So here's the same thing. We have to have the two faces. But the interesting thing about this is it introduces the idea of dispensations into our flight. One thinks of Fourth Ezra's division of all history into a series of dispensations, one black, one white, one black, one white, or the apostolic fathers, the winter time of the just. The world history goes through the summer time of the just and the winter time of the just. We're living in the winter time of the just now, you can be sure of that. And the obvious correlation, the 10 dispensations, First Clement tells us about the 10 dispensations that the earth has seen. Well, this correlation of time is on the hypocephalus too, and it's in the two Horuses that you find here. They are the same. They represent the passing of the phases, we're gonna skip something here, of the moon. Such division on the Janus principle is most succinctly and powerfully set forth in the Book of Mormon adage, to be carnal-minded is death, but to be spiritual-minded is eternal life. Freud, when he says life here is an obsession with just two things, eros and thanatos, sex and death, you see. To be carnal-minded is death, as far as that goes. But this idea of there are two different types of worlds, but this puts it on a moral phase, and alternating in dispensations, too, this comes out. The whole thing is designed on the principle of opposites, and the theme is cosmic. The moral element is not missing. It's fully propounded in Abraham's report in chapter 1. That must always be studied with the facsimile. Read the Abraham story, that brings the moral part in it. It would seem that the hypocephalus goes back to a more spiritually minded age than our own. We're going to be talking about its origin now. The ancient and modern worlds represent the decline of something which few scholars are now beginning to recognize, and something more than a wild surmise. Just as we cannot conceive of what life would be like, see, we're living in another kind of age now, and this came from another world. We might put it this way, going to get mystical on you now, and being all in a rush. Just as we cannot conceive of what, look at that, of what life would be like in a world without oxygen, but recently they had to because of that, an oxygenic world was such a thing, or how could a fish imagine how creatures could possibly live on earth in the emptiness of air. So a spiritually minded civilization is utterly beyond our present comprehension. We can't imagine what they were like. And we are nothing but carnal minded. All living things, as far as we're concerned, are meat and nothing else. Strangely enough, there's a path that leads back to that prehistoric world, which is in which the hypocephali may have had their origin. I'm going to talk about that now. The theory was that all ascension stories we've been talking about proliferating in the vast apocryphal literature, whether they're Jewish or Christian, or Gnostic or pagan, they have a single origin, and the origin is in shamanism. You know, I looked it up in the dictionaries. It's best not to call it shamanism, call it shamanism or shamanism, something like that. A shaman, you know what that is. Now, this has a great deal to do with hypocephali, you'll see about that. For a century, there had been a debate as to just where shamanism began, whether it was lots of candidates. Was it Iran, Thrace, the steppes and woods of northern Asia, Greece, the Balkan Peninsula, all those places have been, even England now. But all agree that the earliest tradition, as Rhoda puts it, have a shamanistic flavor. Stripped of what Holgren calls the astonishing mythological and religious wealth that has accrued to it, the essential elements of shamanism are the shaman's journey to the other world, above and below. The peculiar gadgets with which he equips himself for his heavenly and earthly missions, and the special talisman he must bring back with him to attest the reality of his journey on high. His great adventure, his quote, is the death and resurrection of the candidate by a feigned descent into the underworld and ascension to heaven, unquote. The journey begins with the shaman lying in extreme distress at the point of death, experiencing what long fainting spells and lethargic sleep. In this dangerous condition, he sometimes actually does die. It's very dangerous indeed. You could hardly call it feigned. Though his intention is to die without dying. There's a familiar theme, you see. He feels himself dismembered, but then he's restored and has the experience of being borne aloft to heaven by a bird amidst fire and smoke on the wing of a bird. Genesis 15. He passes in a bark or canoe through the ocean that surrounds the cosmos. Rising above the earth, he beholds everything below him as in a map. His heavenly guide, the bird, instructs him to take notes and write everything down during the journey. At the center of the cosmos, he beholds the universal king on his throne and the cosmic tree from which he's instructed to make himself a drum. In this drum, which serves him both as a roadmap and a passport, enables him to journey wherever he would, even to the center of the world. The drum is, of course, round and is covered with figures. Quote, it depicts the microcosm with its three zones, sky, earth, and underworld. At the same time, it indicates the means by which the shaman accomplishes his breakthrough from plane to plane. You think of something like the Nemus, and with which we began this series of the Egyptians. Well, the parallel is only too obvious. On the round surface with the three zones are painted schematic representations of everything, in particular sun, moon, stars, sacred animals, snakes, boats, hieroglyphs, you see, gods and goddesses, all surrounded by a great ocean stream. Moreover, the drum is also fitted with a handle, for it also serves as a protective shield. Well, we might as well see some of these. Oh, this is something else. I don't think we'll even refer to that. Well, here's one of the drums, you see. And you see, it's the cosmic pattern divided into the four and various creatures on it. And here is another drum. You see, and this tells us what it is. You see, if it goes there, the thunder god, the man of the world, number three, the old man, the shaman of heaven, Rutu, the disease god, sacrificial animals, the bear of heaven, the big bear, very important. See, with the Egyptians, that's the way you go to heaven, is to the big bear, even the Egyptians. And the festival men, the sun. Notice number 13 of the center is the sun. He is the center of everything. And the Christians rode with the churches, well, the Christian influence, house, cow, and goat. The sacrificial horse, the shaman of the underworld is 16. We're down here in the underworld. Asaraka, various names, like villages. And, well, while we have some others here, and we'll look at them in a minute. It's fitted with a handle, for it's a protective shield. And here you see, here this one, this is the handle on the top one. Here is the two sides. This is the face and this is the other. Notice you're not bound by any one pattern, but it does follow the cosmic pattern. Notice this is equally divided with the quadrata and then the various regions. The under, like our own hypocephalus, is divided into two parts that way. And there's the handle, and here's the handle on this one. So you hold it like a drum, but it also serves as a shield. Remember, we had the shield of Achilles, the shield of Levi, and so forth. The shield is an important thing. You don't get away from it. Excuse me. Well, the shaman also has a round mirror, which he must keep with him to behold in it the reflection of the universe. He wears it on his head, or behind his head, or on his breast, or on his back. A shaman, and of course, there's Husson has written a thing quite recently, just a couple of years ago, to show that you could substitute this mirror for a hypocephalus in Egypt. You could use either the mirror or the hypocephalus, or there you are, you see, here we are. On his breast or back, a shaman can perform without costume and drums so long as he has the mirror. Let us note in anticipation that a number of studies have shown that a mirror may be substituted for the hypocephalus. But the cap is also very important, for shamanizing without a cap has no real power. Remember, you couldn't do anything without the Nemus cap in Egypt when he went to get the cap. While the shaman is in heaven, a blacksmith, Khnum and Hephaestus were both blacksmiths, if you remember, forges and shapes his head, of all things, on an anvil and teaches him to read the writings which appear on the glowing object. So his head is sometimes he wears it on his head. We've seen all those crowns and things here. There's both fire and writing on his head, and of course that's what a hypocephalus is. The shamans of the far north have, along with the cosmic drum, a round wooden object with a handle and a hole in the center, the disc, which, quote, they held up in their hand against the sun so that it might shine through it at the winter solstice. Also, a ring of copper was placed in the roof hole of the tent so that the moon could shine through, bringing fertility. Notice the purpose of the hypocephalus, to bring down the spark above and keep it in the head of the person below. That's what they're doing here. You see, they bring fertility to creatures here below. There was a special hand ring held to prevent the moon from withdrawing its light. That is to say, the disk brought down the light of heaven to earth and kept it there and maintained an uninterrupted flow of the divine spark to mortals here below. Well, what else is a hypocephalus? Let's look at some of these then. Oh, excuse me, the wrong one. See, here's some more of them with the figures on them. These are the kind that are divided in two rather than the central part. And here are the handles on them. And the feathers are very important because it's a bird, you see. This shows here. See, the feathers on the handle, this is more of the same. You notice they follow the same pattern just as hypocephala do in the world, but you'd say very primitive, very crude, and so forth, as far as that goes. The disks brought down to heaven to earth are kept. Well, that is to say, the disks brought down the light of heaven to earth and kept it here, maintaining an uninterrupted flow. The solstice, the fertility, the flame around the head, it's all there. The connection appears more obvious in the round copper mirrors, which are thought to be of Sino-Manchurian origin. And the pierced disks that direct light from heaven to earth are certainly related to the Chinese jade disks. So here's the... Oh, here's a hand, a good drum with a handle, you see. The handle on this side, the bear claws or something else. Here is the handle. Says shaman drum with bird-shaped hand grip. Well, what is it that takes him to heaven? You see, he has to hang on to this. It's the bird that transports him, and the handle itself represents the bird. Whether it's in Asia, it's the Garuda bird or the Simurgh, whatever it may be. But it's the bird that takes you to heaven. And see, in all our stories, it's been your bird that takes you there. The pierced discs that direct the light from heaven are certainly related to Chinese jade discs, we say. Those jade discs, 5 to 7 inches in diameter, with a square hole in the center, through which a priest would take sightings of the sun or the moon at critical periods. Shamans also possessed copper rings with central holes and handles for holding up to the sky to direct the light to them, as well as other jade discs. Symbols of deity of heaven, having no handles but adorned with cosmic designs. Widely distributed over the earth as shamans are, they have no standard costume, though feathers must never be lacking to indicate that the shaman is always a bird, an eagle or a hawk. The iron of the copper pectoral discs, the pierced disc represents the earth, the lunar crescents, miniature canoes, metal mirrors with 12 animals on them, more copper mirrors to help the shaman see the world. Every item of the odds and ends that scrap that dangle and clink and flutter around the person of the shaman because some light gadget that turns up in the religious practices of the race. Let me see now. Oh, there's another drum. But here we get to see some of the metal discs, you see. Notice this one is a cosmic pattern, too. Metal discs of various sizes, the kind sometimes worn on the head. You remember the button that the Mongol wears on top of his head, the gold button, which represents all knowledge. He has knowledge of the universe. You see, I haven't got one of those. But these gold discs become very common now. Here he is holding as a shield, but it's a drum, you see here. And here, that blank space in the center is a mirror reflecting the light there. So you have these things. This certainly looks like Egyptian kippish. But this is the back of it, and this is the man, the way he holds it, and he beats it. But the same thing as having a sword and a shield, you have a drum and a drumstick. Same thing, multiple use, so you might as well make use of them here. And there it is with all this stuff that flutters from it. Now here, again, see, this is the back. See, there's your copper ring, and there's your disc about the size of a hypocephalus. You don't want to get too close there. And here's another costume. These are two costumes. The one, though, is the back, says the other's the front. But those in the back show the discs very clearly, you see. And they're very important. They can't be without them, these mirrors and these discs, to help the shaman see the world. These symbols raise the questions as to who is supplying whom. The major problem is whether the religions of the world derive from shaman-like properties, from primitive practitioners. Did we get this from the... Did it start up here in this primitive world, or these people did get it from somewhere else? Well, it's almost generally accepted today. This used to be think this is the primitive origin of these things. No, it's not. These come late, and they are
they come late, and they are, though they are universal, they are, I was going to say something about them, I was going to say it. The main problem is whether they come, yes, and they come from the southwest. They go from the southwest to the northeast. They used to think it was the northeast. From the steppes of Asia up here, they came down to the Near East. It's the other way around. They picked it up, living on the edge here. See about that. Which properties are which? Where did it come from? Though according to Eliade, who's done more work than anyone else on this, the problem of the origin and distribution of the shaman's drum in northern Asia is extremely complex and far from being solved. Holmberg traces the order given to the shaman in heaven. He says, remember, when he's ordered to write everything down, he says, that can only mean you don't find a writing god there. It refers to the writing god of Mesopotamia. For where else was one writing in archaic times? Some see in the shaman cosmology, quote, the storied heaven of the Sumerians and Hindus. Some even find Mandean ideas present, or the elements of Greek mythology, such as the crossing of the river of death in a boat. Some shaman concepts of the afterlife are said to be borrowed from the Russian Orthodox Church, while the gods and goddesses on the drum echo Scandinavian mythology. We could have shown that some of these designs are picked up in Scandinavia too. The tendency in recent years, which Eliade supports, has been to regard shamanism as acquiring by long contact with the most ancient civilizations, the spread being from the more civilized southwest of Asia to the primitive north and east, instead of the other way around. One sees the strongest influence coming from Buddhist and lamest India. But we still ask who's borrowing from whom, when we find a shaman's drum with its complete catalog of cosmic symbolism being thumped to the rhythm of the sphere by female shamans of the Mapuche Indies of Tierra del Fuego, way down to the south there. I couldn't find that issue of the Geographic that had that in it. It's a very good one, though. But they have the typical shamans way down in, at the end of Chile in South America, all the same thing. North American shamanism is just exactly like the other. What student of shamanism has not referred us to the famous paintings from the caves of Lascaux and the Trois Frères and so forth, which I thought I had before. The shaman with his staff and the bird on it and so forth. Everybody's accepted that as shamanism, but that's dated 25,000 BC. So this really goes back, this stuff, you know. Showing shamans in action before the dawn of history. All we can be sure of, as Eliade concludes, is, quote, shamanism is a survival of archaic religious ideology centering in faith in a celestial supreme being and belief in concrete communications between heaven and earth. Buddhist India and Tibet, as at present, have the principal claim on the shamans. When the Buddhist missionary Saint Milarepa wished to occupy Mount Colossia, the axis of the world, the priest of the earlier Bön religion, already in possession of the place, raced him to the top, but fell from his shaman's drum while they were racing, on which he was riding. Milarepa magnanimously allowed him to remain in place, and the art of the mandala was shared between them. Now, the most perfect example, I had some beauties, and we won't go into that. But, the mandala were spiritual sketches of the cosmos and followed a uniform pattern, most conspicuously being the glorious figure in the center of a flaming circle, where four beasts denoting the four cardinal points, like the Egyptian canopic figures, which do, as Joseph Smith says, represent that, they guard the four gates. The great lotus throne in the center, as I say, it's a magnificent reproduction of these, and they disappeared. The great lotus throne in the center supported the disks of the sun and the moon, symbolizing the twin, this is, we're quoting from Olshak's book, which the library claims they never had. I know they had it for years. Symbolizes the twin unity of, I shouldn't have mentioned that, but it's annoying. Symbolizes the twin unity of contrast. The central figure is encircled by spheres of light. Seated on the throne, he holds the mirror in one hand and his small tantric drum in the other. In his picture of the universe, the outermost line of the mandala appears in a circle of flames, as you'd find in a hypersyphilisy, and the one passes spiritually through the flames to move from world to world. Long before Buddhism, quote, since the dawn of time, the circle and the quadrifoil, the earth symbol, also the cosmos, have combined in the graphic expression of unity and perfection of spiritual and temporal power seen in the mandala as the sublime symbol of reconciliation and harmony. Well, I have some inferior mandalas here.
Well, there's another one. There you see the discs. They're very close. See, they have them dangle there. You can't do without them. They have three different kinds, you notice, them metal and so forth. And also the bird-like. Also has to be the wings of birds. And there's, you know, as it says here, a Tartar shaman, a bird type, operating his drum and the rest of it. And here we get to, well, here's more. These are especially good here. This one on the right, you notice, for the discs that dangle from the back. And I had more than I thought. And this, it says, a step decoration ram's horn. It's called ram's horn, carrying a bag from 18th. We don't get away from the ram here, you notice. Here are the discs. The discs are dangling down below. But you notice it's the cosmic pattern, the four quarters of the compass and so forth. But the design on it is ram's horns. So what is this? Everybody borrowing from everybody else? Here's the one that occurs in Scandinavia, you see. Which is this? You see, this is in Lapland, but then down at places like Bergslagen and the Kivik stones and so forth, you find them in Scandinavia, in Sweden. And this says the great mantle of the peaceful deities. This is not the mantle I was talking about, the grand mantle of the Tibetan mantle. There's a Buddhist mantle, and here's the one of the evil genies. You get the idea, you see. They develop the same pattern, same cosmic pattern, goes on here, but I say I really had some beauties there. The great mantle of the peaceful deities and the sacred, is the sacred blazon of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which inevitably sets scholars looking for parallels in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. These have combined in a graphic expression of unity and perfection, of spiritual and temporal power, seen in the mandala as the sublime symbol of reconciliation and harmony. That's what Evans Wentz writes about, the Tibetan ones. The one on the throne is surrounded by a nimbus or aura, whose rays not only suffuse in all directions, but like the rainbow, also connect the earthly and heavenly spheres, performing all the functions of the hypocephalus here. What we have here, he says, is the ground plan of visionary heavenly bodies, and the oldest mandalas depict as well the creation of the world system as members of the multi-millions of world systems, worlds without end. It's cosmology on a grand scale, you see. The great mandala of the peaceful deities is the sacred blazon of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which has inevitably set scholars to looking for parallels in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. This line of investigation has never gotten very far, both because of the late date of the Tibetan version and the unwillingness of Egyptologists to enter into a discussion where they do not control the sources in Tibet. The Tibetan, quote, like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, was to be a guide to the deceased during the intermediate period of 49 days. In Egyptian, it was 70 days. In Tibet, it was 7 times 7 days, 49 days, during the passage to heaven that you have to make the dangerous passage, the fearful passage we're talking about. Both writings, quote, are nothing more than guidebooks for the traveler in the realm beyond death, and both are meant to sustain and reassure those who have entered the fearful passage, that moment when they are neither safely in the one world or the other. The Egyptian writing tablet held by Thoth in the law court corresponds, according to Evans Vance, to the mirror of karma held by Kamaraga, the divine jury, when the deceased is brought to trial. There's one fundamental difference that places the two visions worlds apart. For Buddhism, of all schools, maintains that personal immortality is impossible. In other words, Buddhism holds that individualized mind or consciousness cannot realize reality. For the Egyptian, on the other hand, the eternal survival and glory of the individual, his spirit, his body, his name, his family, his memory, his deeds, etc., even as it was on earth, is the big thing. What was it that attracted Eliade, the tireless investigator of world religion, so strongly to shamanism, of all things? His standard work, we're told, is the first book ever to study the phenomenon over the wide field in which it's found here in religious context. It was the idea, he says, of concrete communication between heaven and earth, unique to shamanism. After all, religio, religion, means a bond or tie to the other world. And where religion fails to offer it, it has failed indeed. Eliade is careful, all his life he looked for that. Eliade is careful to insist that shamanism is neither the oldest nor the most widespread religion,
It's not the first at all. It's not primary. What it does is to combine certain elements that are found earlier throughout the world into a relatively late and astonishingly consistent and well-knit whole, a veritable holon, we call it here, H-O-L-O-N, with a life of its own, though stemming from a larger background. It's to this earlier order of things, in what Santayana calls the high, far-off times, that it might be well to look for the prototype of the hypocephalus. Well, now, you think we can go farther back? Yes, we can go farther back, believe it or not. I suggested here that further rambling must wait until we've explained more fully the characters on the hypocephali. We've never really gone into them, because there are a lot of them, you see. And so, I'm going to have to rush through the next time. I was rather pleased to hear that we're going to be squeezed into three times here, because I'd go on forever and ever at this. The whole purpose was to organize this into something, and all I did was get myself more confused. So, but you see, it's going somewhere, and it's a strange thing that we're finding in the world here. What have we got here? Now, let me see. Is this the end one? Oh, no, this is very important. Notice this from a recent National Geographic. It says, emperors spoke to heaven through pie disks, such as the one bearing dragons above, carved during the Eastern Zhou Dynasty, 770 to 221 BC, from a type of jade called nephrite. The pie was one of the six ritual jade pieces used in burial rites by the Chinese, who saw the stone as the bridge to immortality. Well, that's exactly what a hypocephalus was. See, this is the connection with the heavens, and the emperor spoke to the heavens through the pie disc. It has a hole in it, but the pie disc is a later derivation from the old disc, from the jade discs of the emperors, which are come much more closely to our point here. Now, here is are the jade discs of the emperors. What is this one above? This is an astronomical design. It's covered with stars and so forth. And this is an eyepiece through which the emperor looks. This shows it in operation. See, sketch presumed of the Sun Qi. The emperor is looking through there, and he looks through there, and here he looks through this disk, and this connects him with the heavens. It puts him in the picture. It's a plot. The stars are plotted on it. Here's a breakdown of them. See, this is these notches that put you in particular phases, and here are the stars that represent and so forth. It's quite a complicated thing. The Sun Qi covering the circumpolar regions, 600 BC, used by Lehi, I suppose. But it's the same type that he comes from. So this is quite remarkable, you see, that we go back here, the emperor speaks through one here, a magnificent jade thing. But it connects him with heaven. That's the whole idea. And to do that, he holds it up against the sky and matches it to the sky, the way you do with some astronomical devices. And that's what you do here. See, those notches show you where to place it. And this shows you how to fit it over the eyepiece. And then the emperor looks through it like this. That's the presumed way he does it. And finally, this is what he sees, the sky. So we still haven't been able to get away from this disk, which shows us the heavens, and which connects us, which goes under the head, and which connects the person with the real cosmos, as far as that goes. Well, we're going to have to hurry things up after this, but thank you very much for being so patient with this rather hectic discourse. Since there are somebody left some questions here. All of these questions, I noted, are answered in subsequent talks, if there are to be any. So that's all right. Yes, sir. I don't know. Remember, this can get very boring. The long, hot summer you have heard of. This can be awfully boring. But it doesn't bore me. I'm the one who does the boring. The subject is great. But no, I notice these are all touched upon in things to come. But we may have something to say the next time. Thank you very much.